And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, England, Italy at Wembley. Italy's players hoping to beat the odds and get their account open early, and meanwhile do well in the game too. We ran up all the qualifying news. Scotland at the Euros. Wales on top of the world looking down on Croatia. Plus, man tries to buy quarter to get into club in Manchester. We look at what Sir Jim Ratcliffe's real impact will be. And will United just say no? All of that and perhaps more in this Totally Football Show. Monday, 16th of October. Big day in football. A big day in the Totally Football Show studio as we're joined by Tim Spears. Hi, Tim.
Hi, James.
All right. Jack Lang's with us.
Good morning.
Woo. And Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
Whoa. What's congratulations in Welsh, Tom?
Longa farchiadau. I mean, easy on the congratulations because we haven't secured anything yet. But a seismic win for Wales last night.
We've got James Horncastle on the line a little bit later on, but plenty of Wales chat. Mm. Oh, yeah. Big weekend in international football with France, Belgium and Portugal booking their places to the tournament next summer in Germany. Also, Turkey Sunday night sealing their spot with that big 4-0 win over Latvia. And Scotland, also on Sunday, seeing their place confirmed when their rivals Norway lost against Spain. And, oh yeah, Spain booked their place with that victory too. Well, lots of exciting points about all those games, but I want to talk about Wales, first of all. Here's some Welsh.
Nacky passing all to Dan James. Sinedrach and Wilson! My boy, Wilson! My boy, Cymru! The son, Harry Wilson, Eddie!
What were they saying there, Tom?
Describing Harry Wilson's second goal of the 2-1 win over Croatia.
Right. Nothing is settled yet, but compared to how you felt the last time we were talking about Wales and their prospects, you thought it was all over.
I've scarcely felt less optimistic before a game than I did last night, because Wales' qualification hopes did not look particularly promising, and we knew pre-game that to stand any chance of qualifying automatically, we would need to beat Croatia.
Ranked number six in the world.
Number six in the world. Top three at each of the last two World Cups. And albeit missing several key players with their formidable Modric, Brozovic, Kovacic midfield trio still intact. Josko Gvardiol at the back. So a very dangerous Croatia team. And Wales needing to beat Croatia and Armenia and Turkey to stand any chance of qualifying automatically. Obviously, no Gareth Bale because he has since retired. No Joe Allen. He has retired from international football. Aaron Ramsey injured. Brandon Johnson not there. Right.
How did they do it?
I mean, with the most unexpectedly brilliant performance, there's been a lot of talk on Welsh football Twitter of the last time Wales played this well in a big game. And I think you probably have to go back to the quarterfinal win over Belgium at Euro 2016 in terms of beating one of the world's best teams in a competitive match and in a must-win competitive match. In a game that Croatia really couldn't afford to lose because Wales have now leapfrogged Croatia in the group to put themselves in control of their own destiny. A very sort of mature performance, a kind of medium block. Let Croatia have the ball, which is, what Croatia always want to do, particularly with that midfield that I mentioned before, and sort of kept them at arm's length quite comfortably, and then just very blatantly hit Kiefer Moore with long balls from the back, from the goalkeeper. David Brooks, who was absolutely brilliant, and Harry Wilson, who was man of the match with two goals, running off Kiefer Moore. And that's basically where the victory came from. And Croatia, apart from the last 10 minutes where it got a little bit wobbly, and Danny Ward, who hasn't played a minute of club football this season, really sort of stood up to the mark, claimed every ball that arrived in his six-yard box. And all of a sudden, you know, Wales have beaten one of the best teams in the world and another two victories and will have qualified.
Right, so you need to win away against Armenia.
Yeah, Armenia, who beat Wales 4-2 in Cardiff over the summer, and who can still qualify themselves. They are 3 points behind Wales in fourth in Group D.
Right.
Same number of games.
And then the final game at home to Turkey, which sounds arduous because they're really hitting form under their new manager, Vincenzo Montella. I don't know if you saw their terrific performance against Latvia and that amazing goal from Yunus Akgün, Leicester City's new loanee. Did you see those? Very nice.
Did
seek
not
it
see
out.
It.
Yes. Seek it out.
But I mean, the one positive from a Welsh perspective is that Turkey have now qualified.
Right.
So we'll hopefully be... Can you be on a beach at the end of a qualifying campaign? Whatever the qualifying campaign equivalent is of a team being on the beach. Hopefully Turkey will be there.
Is it seasonally dependent as well? Will they be on the ski slopes?
In November.
Probably not in Turkey.
Early for that.
Probably
as well.
Not in Turkey, no.
Yeah. Well, no, actually there is skiing in Turkey. Yeah. So, well, that's fantastic. And Rob Page, who, again, on Welsh football Twitter, was widely deemed for the chop ahead of this game, no?
Yeah, Rob Page has been fairly widely criticised, who was largely held responsible for Wales's complete non-performance at the World Cup. You know, too much faith in fading stars like Bale and Ramsey, not making substitutions quickly enough, not being reactive enough in games when circumstances started to turn against Wales. And not a very popular figure, generally speaking, not because he's not a nice bloke, but because, you know, he's not done much to suggest that he is capable of turning things around. And the chief executive of the Welsh FA, Noel Mooney, suggested pre-game that, you know, his position was under review. And interestingly, a couple of the players came out and sort of, in a thinly veiled way, criticised Noel Mooney for making those comments and said, look, we're still behind the coach and, you know, these comments were unhelpful. The last thing we need is our own side to be sort of, you know, taking pot shots at the coach. And Page was really emotional last night. He's been in quite a combative mood, you know, over the last few days building up to the game. And pre-match, during the Welsh anthem, the cameras are sort of panning along the players and the camera settles on Page in the dugout. And he was singing. And I think the anthem got to the chorus and then he just stopped singing and obviously, you know, was kind of looked like quite choked up, you know, sort of like watery eyes kind of thing. And then after the game as well, he gave an interview to S4C where he was asked about the build up to the game and some of the pressure he's been under. And again, very emotional. He said, you know, I won't hide the fact that I get emotional talking about this team and my sort of commitment to this job and getting Wales qualified again. So yeah, lots of emotions around.
Yeah, and also in here, Tom, I'm feeling a little bit dusty in here.
honestly, get me talking on Wales and
two great finishes, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, gorgeous. Terrific goal.
The second one, like the kind of twisting fish leap. Love it.
Yeah.
Harry Wilson's four.
It feels like, I don't know if you agree, Tom, it was like a bit of a triumph again for sticking with young players over like a prolonged period of time. Mm. There was like a bit of a clamour for like Paul Mullin and Lee Evans to come in, sort of like maybe short-term fixes. But when you look through that squad, the amount of players in their mid-20s who are sort of around the 50-cap mark, you know, Ethan Ampadu, 23 years old, he's got 47 caps. Mm. Dan James, 25, he's got 47 caps. And obviously this is something that they've done for a while from John Toshak onwards. And despite bad results, you know, they do sort of stick to their guns with these young players.
Yeah, oh, completely. And it felt, I mean, again, we'll have to see how the rest of the qualifying campaign pans out, but it felt like a coming-of-age performance in the sense that, you know, we are now in the post-Gareth Bale era. Aaron Ramsey wasn't there last night. You went through the starting 11 and, with a couple of exceptions, every player in the team is either sitting on the substitutes bench in the Premier League or playing in the Championship. The only survivor from Euro 2016 was Ben Davies. Wayne Hennessy was on the bench. You know, you look at the midfield, Ethan Ampadu, who Tim mentioned, alongside Jordan James, a 19-year-old playing for Birmingham City in the Championship.
Right, who got rave reviews.
He was absolutely fantastic. And yeah, a special mention for David Brooks, who I thought was absolutely brilliant. There was a bit quite early on in the game where he just sort of casually flicked the ball over the head of Josko Gvardiol, the second most expensive defender in football history, kind of volleyed a pass out to the left-hand side. Harry Wilson, brilliant. And Harry Wilson, who has, It's been on the scene for a long time. So last night, it was 10 years to the day since his Wales debut. It was also his 50th cap. And he's very often kind of been in the shadow of Bale, particularly as a left-footed, free-kick-taking attacking player, and Aaron Ramsey. And so last night was him really coming to the fore. But this was very much, you know, a statement victory for this group of players who have lost the guiding light superstar, Gareth Bale, who would single-handedly get them through matches like this in the past. And I think it, you know, quite apart from the qualifying context, it just augurs really well for this team, largely bereft of, you know, kind of household names, to carry on achieving things, carry on qualifying for big tournaments, you know, even without the sort of the stardust that they had previously.
Well, I hope after all that they don't blow it now against Armenia, although both Wales and Croatia still have the potential playoff route that comes from the in no way arcane and indecipherable Nations League playoff repechage.
Yes, mechanism. Or do they?
Or do they? We're not sure.
We're not sure.
And that's after a lot of looking at, graphs, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Hats off once again to Wikipedia and their colour-coded charts on the Euro 2024 qualifying page.
It is pretty good,
page.
Actually. If you look at the Wikipedia Euro qualifying page, and Tom, you directed me to this, and then you scroll a long way down it, you'll find a playoff section, and it will give you a pretty clear idea of how that 12-team playoff mechanism will work. Basically, there are four teams from League A, the top tier, four from League B, and then four from League C, and they have six sets of semifinals.
I mean, I'm glazing over just well,
three,
here.
Three sets I'll move of semifinals.
On. I'll move on.
I treat permutations like transfers, and I think it's better just to wait until it happens.
Gotcha. Quick word for Croatia, though, Tom. They came into this international break top of the group. They're now third and staring at Wikipedia pages in desperation. Did you have any clue from this game what's gone wrong for them?
I think a significant factor was the injuries in attack. So looking at the absentees last night against Wales, no Ivan Perisic, no Andrej Kramaric, no Bruno Petkovic. So they were missing all of their most experienced attacking players. And as a consequence, you got a kind of classic Croatian performance of lots of possession, you know, consummate control of the ball in midfield, you know, Modric and Kovacic put in the strings, but no cutting edge. And they didn't really trouble Wales at all. With Turkey now having qualified and Wales having their destiny in their own hands, it's looking a bit dicey for Croatia.
Indeed so. Tim, Sunday night you were watching Spain's 1-0 victory over Norway, a pastime which you probably shared with lots of Scotland fans.
And a couple, they even had Scottish commentators on the game.
Bursting onto it, Fran Garcia, Gavi looks for it, Ferran Torres to strike it, hits his own man. Gavi finds the corner.
How was the game?
Exactly as you'd expect. So Spain dominating possession and Norway lumping it forward to Haaland. Mm. Yeah, the game was mostly about whether Alvaro Morata wouldn't get in the way of a goal.
And he did.
Which happened twice.
Right.
So there's this interesting moment in the first half where the Norway defender Strandberg hooks across basically into his own net, except that Morata decides to help the ball in from half a yard away. But he's offside, so the goal gets ruled out. And then in the second half, a cross comes in and then comes out to Gavi, who scores. But then VAR took 5 minutes, one of the longest delays I've ever seen, to judge whether Morata was offside for the cross that came in, and then whether he was interfering in the keeper's eye line from the shot. So it's basically, if Morata could get out of the way, they'd score. And yes, this was given. It was a fairly routine 1-0 win, which meant that, Spain and Scotland qualified. And Norway out for the time being. But yes, they may also have a Nations League reprieve, which Jack doesn't want to know about.
Okay. Until it happens. Erling Haaland has now blanked in four of his last five games.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a decent attack, Norway. They've got, obviously, Odegaard. They had young Oscar Bob, who was castigated on this podcast by some idiot called Tim a few weeks ago for having a name like a silent movie star from the 30s. God, I didn't have a clue who he was, but he made his first start for Norway last night. And he was actually okay. But I thought Norway deserved to lose because on the eve of kickoff, they played a Sweet Caroline remix.
Oh, did they?
Which I've never heard anything like it. It was quite disgusting. It was
by. You might be hearing this now because I bet Producer Charlie's googling it even as we speak.
Honestly, I was appalled, but it's by. The sound sounded familiar.
Do you like the original?
No, I can't stand it. Certainly the way it's been picked up on by everyone, right, including Norway, which feels bizarre. But the remix is by, you may remember, a guy called DJ Ötzi.
Oh, yeah.
So he was the...
Flat Eric, yeah.
No. He was the Hey Baby guy.
Oh, yeah.
Hey Baby.
Oh,
that's DJ Ötzi.
Oh. Who did Flat Eric?
I don't know. We both...
Flat Eric was...
Wow, that's not what I...
DJ Wazzo.
That was DJ Wazzo. Again, Producer Charlie. I can't believe people actually went up against him in the quiz.
Just when you think about becoming a DJ, you realise all the good DJ names are taken, aren't they? Your Otzi's, your
and
Wazzos.
And some of the bad ones as well.
My favourite version of Sweet Caroline, Adrian Clarke. I ruined his version at Totally Karaoke.
Oh, right.
For which Jack tried to pull him off the mic.
But anyway, yes, Scotland qualify. Awkward. Woo! Are we excited? They'll do better than last time, you would think, no?
Yeah, they'll want a good draw. I saw them against England last month and they were torn apart, to be honest, by a mixed England team. So there's a definite sort of gap in quality when they come up against the big boys. But if they get a good draw, then yeah, for sure.
Okay. I mean, they did beat Spain, of course, in this qualifying process. Had things gone a different way, sliding VARs and all that, if that McDominay goal had been given what would have been the opener away in Seville last Thursday... Who knows how that game would have finished instead of the, 2-0?
2-0.
2-0. Yeah. Oh, I tell you what, Scotland against big boys, they're playing France in a friendly on Tuesday night.
It is just a shame that qualification was achieved in absentia, isn't it? Because the atmosphere at their games has been such a hallmark of their campaign. You know, I'm sure fans don't care that much and they probably still had a good night out, but it would have been nice to do it on the field.
Yeah.
They're not that picky about how they do it these days, are they?
Back-to-back Euro qualifications for the Tartan Army. Scotland through then. Wales back in with a chance. England are all but there. We'll be talking about them very, very shortly. Republic of Ireland, obviously not. Fourth in Group B. They had their fifth defeat in six. At home to Greece, who beat them 2-0. Greece now have moved past Netherlands, 3 points clear of them, in second spot in Group B behind France, who we mentioned already through. This is huge. Monday night, tonight as we record, Netherlands visit Greece, who've only lost one of their last 18 home games. And that's a must-win game for Netherlands if they don't want to start opening Wikipedia tabs.
There's a ridiculous situation in this group, talking of backstops and qualifiers, where if the Netherlands are still in it against Ireland next month... It would be advantageous for Ireland to lose that game because they would want the Netherlands to qualify.
Right.
It would give Ireland a better chance of the names dropping out and coming down so that they can get a playoff spot.
So they still might get a playoff spot?
They need a few teams to qualify automatically.
Right.
And then they'll get in virtue of their Nations League ranking.
If they lose to Netherlands, they might be able to achieve.
If Greece get through, that's bad for Ireland.
Ah.
But if the Netherlands progress, it's good for Ireland.
Okay.
And of course, Ireland are out, nothing to play for. So they would rather lose against the Netherlands next month.
Good Lord.
In that scenario, which seems crazy.
Wow. I didn't realise that Gus Poyet was Greece manager. Do you know how long he's been there? Since February 2022. I thought this must have happened in the last few months. You've been there ages.
Well, they're in Nations League C, aren't they, Greece? So they have been on the slide a little bit.
Oh,
so maybe
they've
not had the juicy fixtures that would bring them
next
into your...
summer will mark 20 years since they did the big one, beating Portugal in the Euro 2004 final. Oh, one other thing to mention, Luxembourg fans, because bizarrely they seem to become a kind of niche team for Totally Football Show listeners to follow. They still have qualification in their own hands. They're playing Slovakia this evening in Group J. If they win that game and their two remaining ones, which are against Bosnia and Liechtenstein, then they're through. That sounds doable, but let's see. All right, that's enough about all of that. Next up, let's get on to Tuesday night's big game at Wembley, England-Italy.
Football is bigger and more complicated than ever before. Just ask VAR.
Check complete. It's fine. Perfect. Yeah.
So the Daily Football Briefing is here to help, whether it's the World Cup.
It's a kind of face-saving. Everyone's happy. No one's a loser.
Lionel Messi.
As they say, he completed football.
or Manchester United.
I mean, the performances all season have been questionable.
That are making you quizzical. The Daily Football Briefing has all the answers you need for every football story that matters, and it does exactly what the name suggests. It's daily, it's brief, and it's all about football. The Daily Football Briefing from The Athletic, available wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
England, Italy, Tuesday at Wembley. England 3 points clear now at the top of Group C of Italy and Ukraine, who are level in the race for second place. England still not guaranteed qualification then, but Tuesday's game a must-win affair for the Azzurri. James Horncastle joins us now. Hello, James.
Hello, Jimbo.
All right. So last time these two teams met in Naples, it was 2-1 England. Might Tuesday be different and why?
Well, it will be different, James, because there's a new coach in charge of Italy. Some players who were available for that game in Naples, which, as you mentioned, Italy lost, are unavailable. They are Nicolò Zaniolo and Sandro Tonali, who were sent home because they're not in the right frame of mind after being questioned by police in relation to this probe into illegal online betting platforms. And some of the star players, you know, Chiesa, for example, is injured. That said, Italy have won two of their three games under Spalletti. The toughest probably being the one against Ukraine at San Siro, where, you know, having drawn against North Macedonia in the first game under Spalletti, that was the most pressurised encounter, I suppose. You mentioned this is a must win. Is it? You know, I mean, ultimately, if they win, England, I don't think it changes too much because England still have very winnable games against Malta and North Macedonia. I don't expect...
No, but from the point of view of getting the other spot and rather than Ukraine taking it.
Sure, but they have the edge on head-to-head, having beaten Ukraine at San Siro. They will play them again. Worst comes to the worst, Italy could finish bottom of this group and they would still have a playoff, which, yes, of course, they would like to avoid, having lost one against Sweden going into the 2018 World Cup and lost in North Macedonia before the 2022 World Cup. But people seem to have forgotten that by dint of qualifying for the final four of the Nations League, as they kept doing, they have guaranteed themselves a playoff anyway. So, yeah, it's a big game. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I think Italian football has bigger problems right now.
All right. We're going to focus on the national team, though. And obviously it is without, as you mentioned, Zaniolo and Tonali. But of the players that are there, are we beginning to see the first signs of Spalletti ball in terms of his call-up and in terms of the way they played, especially in the second half against Malta, admittedly, you know, asterisk Malta?
I mean, I think they've played some good football under him already. It's very early to expect that. You know, I mean, even for the first hour against North Macedonia, I thought they played well. They hit the post, they hit the bar, but, you know, everyone ended up seeing that game through the prism of the fact that they conceded 3 minutes before full time and ended up drawing. Yeah, I mean, they're playing 4-3-3, which they did for the most part of Mancini's reign. Even though Mancini dabbled with playing three at the back towards the end of his time in charge. There are some new faces, not entirely new in that they'd already made their debuts under Mancini. But, for example, Immobile at this moment in time, he was not called up because he's had a number of injury problems. So Giacomo Raspadori, who scored in the win against England in the Nations League at San Siro, he's been playing as a number nine. Moise Kean played on the left against Malta in Chiesa's absence and played really well. I thought he was involved in both of Italy's goals, won the ball back for both of them. And then there's Giacomo Bonaventura, who feels like the classic. This is just a cliche of the narrative around Italian football, the late bloomer, the guy who everyone suddenly appreciates as being a top-class player, or as Spalletti called him, our Bellingham.
Did he really? Jack Bonaventura?
He did, yeah.
Lovely stuff. Yeah. How important, though, is Domenico Berardi coming back in?
Well, it's very important, but you know, people have just completely underrated this player for a long, long time because he's not called Chiesa. Well, he's a better player than Chiesa. And he has been, you know, I mean, ever since he scored four goals against AC Milan in one game, what, 10 years ago? I mean, this is a guy who scored more than 100 goals in Serie A, as one of the best left foots in European football. And, you know, if he wasn't still playing for Sassuolo, I think people would be saying that this is, along with Verratti, the best Italian player of his generation. You know, even scored with his right foot against Malta. So, you know, he's a class player, and he will probably be the main threat to England on Tuesday night at Wembley. But, you know, it's a very different Italy team from the one that that won the Euros in 2021. You know, that doesn't feel all that long ago. But if you think about it, Chiellini retired from international duty when they failed to reach the World Cup. Bonucci's sort of not in the squad because he's been, you know, he obviously was frozen out of the Juventus team and then moved to Union Berlin at the last day of the transfer window. You've got guys who are used to playing in a back three for their clubs, playing in a back four. So, you know, Bastoni and Mancini or Scalvini, as it was against Ukraine. Udogi came on to make his Italy debut against Malta, having started the season really well for Tottenham. The midfield is kind of two-thirds different from the one that beat England at Wembley last time around, in that Verratti is now playing in Qatar, Jorginho is, you know, hanging out in West London. And the attack as well. I mentioned Chiesa being injured, as he so often has been over the last 18 months to 2 years. Immobile, you know, who is so fed up with the criticism.
2 years.
Well, no, he scored against North Macedonia.
Oh, did he? Oh, September. Sorry. Okay, right.
Yeah. Again, unfairly maligned. This is why he's been threatening to leave Italy over the past week, because of people like you, Richardson, who forget that he's capocannoniere, what, four or five times, and just fail to put respect on his name. Mm. So Raspadori, and then Berardi, who lost his place to Chiesa in the Euros, because Chiesa played on the right in that tournament. Insigne was playing on the left. So it's a, you know, we're talking maybe only three players who were part of the Italy team in 2021 will be part of this one.
All right. James, you mentioned the victory at the last Euros 2021. That was at Wembley, of course. The Italians have quite a tradition of big wins at that venue. Zola, head of the 98 World Cup.
Oh, what a goal that was.
What a goal. Oof. Fabio Capello, a goal for all of Waiterdom what was that, 73? 73.
I think so.
Yeah.
Can't remember.
Early 70s. Do you have a feeling that we might see another one on Tuesday night?
Well, I mean, the preparation hasn't been ideal, even though, you know, sort of within the camp, I think they feel that they performed well against Malta, regardless of who the opponent was. And that has given the team some confidence in its current kind of setup. Now, I wouldn't put it past Italy to win this game. But when the players are training in an environment where there's a paparazzo out there threatening to out players who've been betting, you know, you can imagine it leads to quite a lot of anxiety. Mm. But I think the thing that's stood out to me over the last few days is just the reverence that there already is in Italy for Bellingham. All of the players are being asked about him in a way that I can't remember Italian players being asked out about an England player of that age. You know, even Kane, I can't remember Kane getting this kind of treatment as though, you know, Bellingham is the outstanding player in European football right now. Mm. And, you know, a lot of the questions being popped to the likes of, you know, Davide Fratesi, who we haven't mentioned, but Fratesi's the top scorer for Italy, even though he's a midfield player, he's not starting for Inter or Italy, but is this super sub who comes off the bench and scores. You know, he was asked about him. Barella was asked about him. I mean, it's all about Bellingham. So Yeah, must say I'm quite proud, James. Mm. You know, to hear people in a country that we've worked in be so so respectful and so admiring of a young English player.
Well, there you go. Can I finish off with a question from Mr. Crypto?
Oh my God! Yeah. Okay. No, I'm not going to put any of my money with him.
Well, he had another one. It was, has Lewis Ferguson been playing well enough to get a run out in the friendly against France, bearing in mind he plays in the same position as Scott McDominate and McGiniesta, who are difficult to dislodge from the starting 11 in his form? Mr. Crypto wants to take on how well Lewis Ferguson's been doing.
Well, Lewis Ferguson should be playing for Scotland because it doesn't really matter what position you put him in. You know, I mean, this has been the great story about his time at Bologna playing for Thiago Motta, is that he's played as a false nine, he's played off the left, he has played as a number eight. So he's super versatile and it hasn't affected his performances. He's been very consistent. I think he was Bologna's man of the match against Inter where they came back from 2-0 down and drew 2-2. So yeah, he absolutely should be in the team. If they've, you know, I'm not going to criticise the coach because Scotland have qualified. But, you know, you've got a very versatile player there who you could integrate into a starting 11 regardless of what you think his best position is or not, because Thiago Motta has shown it doesn't really matter where you play him. He's an outstanding talent.
Magnificent. Very nice, James. Thank you so much. Enjoy the game Tuesday evening and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Pleasure.
James Horncastle. Just to flesh out that illegal betting platforms probe thing, this has been something that the Turin police have been doing for a while, unrelated to football, but then footballers' names started coming up. And as James mentioned, this paparazzo, doing air quotes here, called Fabrizio Corona, who you may recall the name because he was blackmailing Serie A footballers back in, well, this is ages ago. This, I think, was in the noughties that he...
David Trezeguet.
Gilardino and Trezeguet. And ended up doing time for it. Basically, he would take indiscreet pictures of them. Adriano was another one. And then, as he would say, he would offer them advantageous prices to buy the photos so that he didn't sell them to publications. Did the same with Berlusconi's daughter. I think one of the Agnellis as well, he was doing it too.
Football heritage.
Yeah, football heritage. Anyway, he now runs a website, a kind of gossip site, and he got wind of the fact that Nicola Fagioli, who's not in the Italy team but has been very much, he's kind of the thread that the investigator's been pulling on, that he was gambling, which footballers are allowed to do as long as it's not on their own sport and on authorised, basically legal, online services. And what the suggestion is these guys have been doing is not using those. Zaniolo, his lawyer, has said that he hasn't been doing any betting, but the suggestion is that that was for playing poker online, and whether that will have any impact, I don't know. The Gazzetta this morning very much has Fagioli, the Juventus midfielder, cooperating fully with the inquiry and in therapy, because apparently, the suggestions are it's quite an issue for him and for Tonali, who similarly, they say, is intending to cooperate fully but could be hit with a major sanction by the FIGC as a way of sending a bit of a message. But as James was mentioning again, this paparazzo Corona has hinted at the fact that he's going to be dropping further names in the course of the next month and will be bringing Calcio to a halt with this revelation.
Coronavirus.
Wow.
Yeah. An unsavory character in the finest Italian football traditions.
Wow. Well, yeah. Anyway, this game... Tim, you'll be going along Tuesday night.
Yes.
All right. How much trouble would defeat leave England in?
None. They got Malta at home next, so
okay.
Even England wouldn't mess that one up.
Okay.
That's a nice little safety net for them. But I guess from England's point of view, it's it'll be the last decent sort of competitive test against a good team that they have before the Euros. Really. Yeah. Southgate talking the other day. We've only got 5-6 games left before the tournament starts.
What are the big questions he needs to sort out?
Well, I think he's got issues in each position on the pitch, really. In my mind, I mean, he might not see it that way because he's got people that he's earmarking will play come what may, I think, like Calvin Phillips, who someone worked out the other day is now the eighth choice midfielder at Man City. But he didn't kick a ball the other night against Australia, which was Southgate's Carabao Cup team, effectively. So it looks like he was being set up to start against Italy. And if he does, if I was Calvin Phillips, and there's loads of talk, oh, he needs to get out in January and get some game time so he nails his spot in the Euros, I'd be going absolutely nowhere. Because if he ends up going to West Ham on loan in January and plays his way out of form, then that's the only way he'll lose his place. But if he's eighth choice midfielder at Man City and still gets in England's first choice team, which, you know, he probably will do, there's a real dearth of midfielders. Hence why Jordan Henderson is captain the other night and still in this squad, despite playing in Saudi Arabia. But Southgate doesn't fancy James Ward-Prowse by the look of it. He's dropped Mason Mount. So in his mind, there's a real dearth of midfielders. I thought Trent Alexander-Arnold was really impressive against Australia and has been against pretty inferior opposition, Malta and North Macedonia in June. He's a really interesting option for midfield, but it's one of those interesting creative options. Don't get that extra spot in England's midfield. So hence why Phillips is probably still the man at the moment.
Good Lord. Are you looking forward to going along to Wembley?
I am looking forward to going along to Wembley. It should be a... Yeah. The other night was a little bit underwhelming. My first game covering England at Wembley. I was very excited.
It was the first time you've been there since 1992?
First time I've watched England at Wembley since 1992.
Wow. And what did you see in 1992?
England 2, Holland 2.
Okay.
Which was a World Cup qualifier in Graham Taylor's ill-fated campaign. And John Barnes was booed but scored a free kick.
Is he playing in Saudi Arabia?
He's playing for Liverpool, I think. And Dennis Bergkamp scored a lovely goal.
Why was Barnes booed?
I think it was one of those where it was sort of seen as underachieving, maybe.
Right.
Maybe along the same lines that like why Frank Lampard got booed. And I wrote about this the other night, actually, in terms of how curious it is that some England players get booed and some don't. Because, of course, Henderson was booed.
Yeah.
When he was subbed the other night, which felt like quite a thing. And there are all sorts of peculiar reasons. You know, Ashley Cole got booed for infidelity reasons, which is just bizarre when you think about it. Wayne Rooney got booed, and I can't really remember why. It was one of his last appearances against Malta, who's in midfield. He's already England's record goal scorer at this point and record outfield cap holder, and he got booed. It's a weird phenomenon, getting booed for England. Everybody will be booed. I said it in a piece the other day. Jude Bellingham will be booed one day. Well, everyone else is. I think Terry had it. Lampard, maybe Gerrard. I'm sure Beckham would have had some after 98.
Yeah.
Barnes, Rooney, they all get it at one point or another.
Incredible. I thought the booing of Henderson was quite refreshing in that it was like morally unproblematic booing. Obviously, you shouldn't boo your own players. That goes without saying. It's counterproductive, etc. But given some of the
more... Is it counterproductive?
Well,
in the long term, might it not have an impact? It's not going to help their performance on the field unless they're one of those players who use that. But
depends very much on the individual, I think.
Right.
But just generally speaking, fans booing their own players is not felt to be very helpful.
Right.
But I think given the recent context of England booing, like Harry Maguire getting booed for being not in form, is a pretty appalling reason for booing one of your own players. But I felt like the booing of Jordan Henderson was a reflection of, you know, kind of what the nation thinks of his choice to go to Saudi Arabia. I think people, you can't know for sure what was in the heads of the booers.
Right.
But it felt like they were expressing disappointment with Jordan Henderson on a personal level, which I think is a disappointment that we all felt when he decided to go to Saudi Arabia.
Reinforced by the disingenuousness of his remarks afterwards when he said, oh, I don't know why they're booing me. Why could that possibly be? You know, he was the one who gave the interview to The Athletic and presumably witnessed the massive fallout. We talked about it on this show. For him to say, he made some allusion to, they're angry at someone playing in a different country. The specifics of it are very relevant there.
But Southgate was of the mind that it wasn't, 10,000 people standing up for LGBTQ plus rights. He was of the mind that, people have just got it in for Jordan Henderson and this is a stick that they beat him with, which I'm inclined to sort of agree with, really. I don't know. The Henderson-Maguire thing's been going on for a few years now. They always get picked. So I feel like this is sort of made him sort of cross over into the boo boy territory. But I don't think it's people...
Was it just a small minority at Wembley? Was it not a true reflection?
At first, it was one man who was booing his every touch. One man, he was really loud, but it was one man. I don't know if you can hear it on TV. But yeah, when his number went up, you knew it was coming. It was, a couple of thousand.
Brilliant. All right, that's the situation ahead of England-Italy on Tuesday. Of course, we'll be looking back on that in Thursday's show. Next up, though, we'll get a quick check on what the hot stories are in South America as World Cup qualifying proceeds over there, and also hear about these shock developments at Manchester United.
Hello there, Ayo here. Listen to me on the Athletic Football Podcast, where we go deep on the biggest stories in the game, providing insights and analysis from the very best journalists in the business. You won't get this anywhere else. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places. Just search the Athletic Football Podcast now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
Full-time Europe will be up on Monday. That, of course, is The Athletic's Women's Football Podcast, covering the latest weekend of action in the WSL. Merseyside Derby, return of Beth Mead. Pretty key return it was as well. She helped Arsenal to their first win of the season. Anyway, you can hear all about that and so much more in Full-time Europe. Jack.
James.
CONMEBOL.
Pretty good.
Got World Cup qualifying 2026 round four. Is that right?
Three's just finished. Four is in the next couple of days.
Okay, so we're on to round four in the next few days. What are the hot stories?
Argentina are the only side with a 100% record now. Still haven't conceded a goal in their three games.
Emi Martinez, the last goal he conceded was in the World Cup final.
Yeah, which is a good stat, but it's even more amazing when you think about, you know, it's not on paper a bulletproof defence. You've got Nicolas Otamendi, who's, you know, was seen as quite an erratic player 10 years ago, and you pair him with Cristian Romero, you know, obviously World Cup winning players, so a bit of respect is due. But you don't look at that side and think, wow, that's definitely going to keep a clean sheet every game. So fair play to Scaloni for that continued success. Brazil dropped points at home to Venezuela.
Yeah, this was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I mean, Venezuela and Bolivia historically are the two teams you just, you know, pick up four wins against. So yeah, the fact they lost, they were pretty wayward, really. Gabriel scored his first Brazil goal from a corner, and then they were just very wasteful. Great goal from Venezuela, Eduard Bello, with a kind of tumbling overhead kick.
It was a beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Eduard Bello, I think a lot of us read that, and producer Charlie immediately chipped in. So he's basically falling backwards and volleys it over his head. And producer Charlie tweeted, Bello horizontal, which is really
good.
Nice. Got no love on the site.
Got a paltry one like on the site forming on his Twitter. Anyway. But Charlie let it be known that he would, you know,
deserved more.
It's a great goal.
Against a little great goal. Great goal. And then you had the spectre, obviously, Brazil failing to beat Venezuela at home is naturally a bit of a...
Puts them in real jeopardy of not making it as well, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, they could stumble multiple times and still get there with their eyes closed. But so there was this scene at full time of Neymar, I don't know if you saw this, kind of got some fan chucked a packet of popcorn at him as he was heading into the tunnel.
Does that have some significance?
I'm not sure, probably not intentionally, but funnily enough, pipoqueiro, which means popcorn seller, also has a connotation in football, which is someone who kind of lets the game pass them by, a luxury player or someone who isn't always involved. So there was probably a layer of meaning that the thrower hadn't fully comprehended. I mean, it was a full packet of popcorn, so perhaps he'd been keeping it. He or she had been keeping it, hadn't been tempted to eat the popcorn because he knew it would be a...
That's fabulous, though, if they did, if they'd gone for, you know, targeted... Obviously, booing your own fans is never a good thing, Tom, but throwing popcorn... Mm.
We can make an exception for
similarly
Neymar.
Similarly, metaphorical protest, you know, Dutch fans throwing a chocolate leg or
unlikely
something
to hurt you, a packet of popcorn has that in its favour. But Neymar was incensed, and it's kind of created this slight discourse afterwards about how Brazil should learn to love Neymar, and his kind of teammates are defending him. And it's a very on-off relationship there.
Is Neymar similarly viewed in Brazil these days?
I would say to
his image over here.
Broadly speaking, it's a lot more positive, particularly when he's playing for Brazil. So you'll see, I mean, in the last World Cup, there's kind of there's been a movement to show him public support, and what kind of very symbolic stuff, like everyone changed their Twitter profile picture to be a picture of Neymar. And I think there's, broadly speaking, a defensiveness about how he's viewed here, because obviously his record for Brazil is pretty unimpeachable. And there's also a feeling that he's been a bit unlucky, and that, you know, Brazil's biggest failings over the last decade have come when he's not there. So he missed the 2014 World Cup final, the World Cup semi-final against Germany. And when Brazil finally did win a trophy, the Copa America in 2019, he was injured. So there's this kind of gap on his trophy cabinet, as it were, that I think a lot of Brazilians would like filled. But that said, there is also...
You can put the popcorn in.
Indeed. There is also, you know, a minority, I would say, that feel he is everything that's wrong with kind of modern football, which... Okay. Yeah. But anyway, there's going to be some changes for Brazil, who play Uruguay away. Marcelo Bielsa's
new side.
And there's, in the fullback positions for Brazil, so this is Tuesday night, it's looking like it's going to be Carlos Augusto, Inter Milan's second choice left wing back, and Yann Cotto, who plays on loan at Girona from Man City, Brazilian. Obviously, Brazilian play for Brazil. But a 21-year-old who's kind of... I saw him at the Under-17 World Cup a few years ago, and he was really good then. And he's looks like he's going to get his senior debut. So Uruguay's wingers could fancy their chances against two rookies.
Well, 10 teams in South American qualifying. 6 of them go through automatically, 6 of 10.
Yeah.
And then the other one gets a playoff against Oceania?
Yes.
Oceania. So you generally get the South American team in the playoff going through. So, yeah, effectively, probably 7 out of 10 actually make it to the World Cup.
You fancy your chances, yeah.
And Brazil, Uruguay-Brazil is?
Tuesday night.
Early hours, Wednesday morning?
Yes, very early hours. But if you want a date for your diary, Brazil v Argentina is the 21st of November. So that is the next international break.
Get the popcorn in, as they say. Nice.
And on Neymar, I can't claim to have watched much of slash any of his games in Saudi Arabia, but the clips that I've seen does look really bleak. Like, he's obviously put a bit of weight on, even more so than he had on him when he was last seen in a PSG shirt. The stadium's aren't always full, the standard's obviously pretty poor, and he's not the player he was. He thinks he still is, and we saw this latterly at PSG. He thinks he can still spring past 20 something fullbacks from a standing start, and he can't, but he still tries anyway. And it kind of feels like he's sort of, in club football at least, like this is his final form. Like, he was always going to end up playing here. It kind of feels like this trajectory, some players have ended up in Saudi Arabia almost against their wishes, and I'm not sure Neymar would ideally want to be there, but it does feel kind of fitting in a strange way that is what he has become.
But that feeds into the Brazil stuff, because you get the sense that he's desperate to be loved at this stage and kind of appreciated for the player he has been. And yeah, with Brazil, it's always just, there's always a psychodrama lurking kind of on the fringes. And I think Neymar's kind of last stand, as it were, heading into the next World Cup is going to, potentially override quite a lot of things.
But it's a bit of a kind of Wayne Rooney syndrome, right? In the
Definitely.
Case that he is like the one unquestionably world-class player that Brazil have and has been for a little while, and so personalises the team's fortunes in a way that Rooney did for so long.
It's like Tim says, stick around long enough and you'll get booed.
There you go.
Mm. We'll wrap up this show as soon as possible then. In fact, just one thing left to do, and that'll be up next, and it concerns Manchester United.
Hi, I'm Ian Irving, host of Talk of the Devils, the Athletic's podcast dedicated to Manchester United. Twice a week, I'm joined by Andy Mitten, Carl Anker and Laurie Whitwell as we bring you the very best insight from inside Old Trafford. You'll get all you need to know on transfers, tactical analysis, dare I say takeovers, and much, much more as we follow United home and away. You're not getting this anywhere else. So search for Talk of the Devils and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Say one thing to do, but actually two, because today's the 16th of October, and on this day, 55 years ago, Manchester United became the first English club to compete in what was called then the Intercontinental Cup. These days, what would you call it? The Club World Cup?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This was all the way back in 1968, Numbers fans. It was a two-legged affair back then. They drew 1-1 away with Estudiantes of Argentina in an ill-tempered affair. In fact, the Pathé News reported it thus.
For 90 unglamorous minutes, the good name of sportsmanship on the soccer field was smeared beyond recognition.
Estudiantes' goal, by the way, scored by Juan Ramón Verón, father of Juan Sebastian. Then Manchester United lost 1-0 at Old Trafford. And thus, Estudiantes were the world champions. Woo!
I have to say, like, the dark arts isn't really captured in the footage.
Not really, no. We had a look at this.
Yeah. I mean, the only real dirty play that occurs is George Best punching someone in the face.
Yeah. There's for a which great, he got sent off.
There's a great clip, I think, from that one of those two games of Best dribbling past an opponent who basically just tries to take a chunk out of his thigh, and the referee blows for a foul. And Best responds by picking the ball up and walking over to his opponent and sort of presenting it to him, like reaching out. That's the thing you're after, mate. Not my, you know.
Not my thigh.
Not my thigh.
There's some lovely Bobby Charlton dribbling in this game, by the way, as well. Yeah,
I mean, they were notoriously violent, those Intercontinental Cup games around that period. And it was very often Estudiantes who were in the final, who were one of the most violent football teams of all time. And in a kind of, not just, you know, there's a to draw a distinction between different types of violence. There's a kind of like Wimbledon crazy gang violence. It's like a kind of like an open,
cartoon.
We are going to kick you around,
right.
But, you know, it's all good natured at the end of the day. Whereas the Estudiantes were very sneaky. And there's all sorts of stories about the things that they used to get up to. And it was, I think, one of the reasons why. Oh, like carrying pins around so they could sort of stab opponents, looking up tragedies in the personal lives of players on the opposition team, and then just, you know, whispering, how's your auntie?
Popcorn.
You know, while you're waiting for a corner. Popcorn, you know, you name it.
In the days before Wikipedia as well,
say,
that's no
that's
mean
some
feat.
Research.
Yeah.
Going to the British library to kind of, you know.
Yeah.
That's quite something.
Anyway, well, it proved effective in 1968 as they conquered Man United and won the world crown. Anyway, speaking of Man United, and indeed conquering them in a manner of speaking, after almost a year of Glazer dithering, it looks like we might finally have some movement on ownership. This weekend, you probably saw Sheikh Yassim of Qatar pulling out of the running to buy the club. And Sir Jim Ratcliffe of Manchester apparently on the verge of completing a deal, but for only 25%, a minority stake. How does that work? Does this represent a new start? What's it mean for the stadium? Adam Crafton joins us now. Adam, Sheikh Jassim out, Jim Ratcliffe partially in. How big is this news?
Well, it's big in that it's just been going on and on for so long. You know, it's almost back to the World Cup when Manchester United announced that there would be a strategic review. There was never a commitment in that statement that the club would be sold. It was, you know, going to explore strategic alternatives, talking about things like the club needing to do significant work on its stadium and infrastructure. And they'd essentially, they didn't have money to do that within the club. And clearly, you know, we all know the story of the Glazer ownership is that they were never going to be putting their own money into kind of £1 billion redevelopment of a stadium or building a new stadium or whichever way they went about it. I think the outcome is probably not what people expected throughout the process, and that, you know, you've had very, very confident briefings throughout from the Qatari side, from the Sheikh Jassim bid. But also, we're not quite sure yet whether those original questions, those questions of investment in the stadium, investment in infrastructure, are necessarily what this deal will mean, because the deal, if it's ratified at a board meeting on Thursday, will be, I think, 25% of the club for Jim Ratcliffe, for Ineos. And in return for that, he appears to be getting control of the club's football operations, which is a very unusual thing for a minority partner of a football club to basically be able to make the decisions about the football side of the business, which arguably defines so much of the rest of the business's ability to succeed. So it's not quite what we expected. I think if you were to tell Manchester United fans 6 months ago this is what it would end up as, there'd probably be some exasperation. If you were to have told them 18 months ago that you would have, you know, one of the richest guys in the world in Jim Ratcliffe coming in as part of what, you know, what is being suggested as a phased takeover, so, you know, the starting pistol, I suppose, for moving the Glazers out of the club, then I think there'd have been a lot of optimism. But as ever with the way Manchester United work, kind of the way they've done it and how slow it's been has led it to feel like a more frustrating process.
So essentially what you're saying then is that the Glazers will still own 75% of the club, but Sir Jim Ratcliffe will run it for them.
Kind of. I mean, the Glazers don't own 100% of the club as it is. I think that figure is
96?
More like...
96?
I think that's of the voting rights. Okay. And then of the shares, there's sort of institutional investors and private shareholders and all that kind of thing, because it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. So it will bring those percentages closer. But what we don't yet know is how it will all shake out in terms of which kind of shares Jim Ratcliffe will buy, which voting rights they will necessarily have. Hopefully that will come in time in terms of the transparency. It will have to, because United are listed on the stock exchange. But yes, clearly, you know, the majority shareholders, it looks like, will still be the Glazers, and they will be essentially delegating the responsibility of running the football operations at a football club.
Okay. In terms of things that would require a major investment like stadium redevelopment, what does that mean?
Again, I'm very cautious about this whole thing of kind of speaking on behalf of these billionaires that don't do very much talking for themselves, and that there's a lot of kind of briefings and counter briefings. And the reality is, I think with those kind of issues around pledges of what's going to be invested into stadiums and major infrastructure, I feel like they kind of need to say it themselves, right? I think there was some reporting yesterday suggesting that they would be prioritising investment in the team and staff changes and perhaps the training ground before getting onto Old Trafford. There was some other reporting in the Times today to say that they'd like to try and make Old Trafford into a 90,000 stadium. Now, that's clearly work that would be, I think, massively encouraged. You know, Old Trafford is one of the biggest stadiums in the country, but it's not one of the most modern or progressive ones, you know, when you compare it to the ones that have been built over the last 20 years or so. And that's, I think that's, you know, from every kind of experience, it's, you know, I think the people who have been going to Old Trafford for 40 years will say it all looks a bit run down, but also investors that see huge upside in hospitality suites and the money that can be made from those kind of experiences, also look at Old Trafford and say that's not good enough. I don't think it's as simple as sometimes people talk about stadiums only in terms of fan experience or hospitality experience, but I think at Old Trafford it just all needs a bit of updating.
Adam, I'm sure a lot of United fans would like to have seen an outright transfer of ownership here and Sir Jim coming in for just 25%. Is that still broadly then, to sum up, good news, or is there the spectre of this just making things more complicated in terms of taking the club in the direction it needs to go?
I think it's definitely complicated. You know, you remember when Arsenal had that situation where you had the Kroenkes and Usmanov for quite a long time, and it can lead to this feeling of conflicting agendas within a club. Also, whose fault is it if something goes wrong? And are you just going to have a situation where one side starts briefing, well, it's all the Glazers, and the other side say, no, he's come in with this idea, they were going to run football operations, now they've messed it up. You know, so I think that's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting as well, because if Jim Ratcliffe is on this journey towards a phased control, if you like, of the club, if not a full takeover of 100%, then he will need to sort of start to develop a trust and transparency with the fan base, which means he will, I imagine, be communicating much more than the Glazers have done over the last 15 years. And he will, I think, you know, if you look at what the Chelsea owners have done since they've come in, they've quite often referred to how difficult their inheritance was, right, when trying to explain some of the mistakes perhaps that they've made since then. And Jim Ratcliffe's not going to be able to do that if he's in a business partnership with the Glazers. He can't just come out and say, well, this was wrong, this was wrong, this was wrong, and Joel did this and Avi did that. It would be very, very messy. So I think Manchester United fans are almost going to have to bite their tongues a little bit when Jim Ratcliffe maybe starts doing interviews and says, you know, these are good business partners for me, we're working together, we're trying to achieve stuff together, when probably they just want to hear these guys have been a disaster for 20 years.
Indeed so. Adam, thank you so much for that. Look forward to the next set of developments.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Adam Crafton. Very nice. So Jim is a man who's achieved great success, and some of it in the sporting fields as well. Tom, I'll look at you because his niece team, after some seasons of struggling to, you know, get their ducks in order, are currently absolutely flying in Ligue 1, aren't they?
They are, although I would caveat that by saying that this is pretty much the first time we have seen them fly since he took over. So he took over in 2019, and there was big talk of Nice becoming like the PSG of the Mediterranean coast and, you know, building a really strong club to compete with PSG for the Ligue 1 title and European honours, etc. And it just hasn't happened. They've spent a reasonable amount of money, haven't finished any higher than fifth. They've gone through a very significant number of coaches. Patrick Vieira, Lucien Favre came back at one point and then promptly left. And then what's happened over the last sort of couple of seasons is that they've decided to kind of water down the ambitiousness of the spending, and they hired over the summer a young Italian coach, Francesco Farioli, who is working with a squad largely bereft of star players, and they've been brilliant. Currently second in Ligue 1, unbeaten. They've won away at PSG, they've won away at Monaco, so currently are better placed than they have been, you know, ever since Ratcliffe arrived. But I don't think you'd find many Nice fans who would tell you that his tenure has been an unqualified success.
All right then. Well, we shall see if this part ownership gets ratified on Thursday, when coincidentally we'll be back doing another Totally Football show. That's it for today's edition. Many thanks to you, Tim, and Tom, and Jack, and Charlie, and Rachel, and you, listener. Do join us on Thursday and have a great time. In the meanwhile, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.